It's Philosophy Talk.
What does the future hold for the field of philosophy? We asked three up-and-coming philosophers. Brian Weatherson from Cornell.
One of the things I think will happen a lot is our conception of what is philosophy will change.
Elizabeth Harmon from NYU.
Artificial intelligence, for example, just raises new questions. We're going to encounter beings that we're going to have to ask new questions about which things count morally.
Sean Kelly from Princeton.
In order to get really clear on the philosophical questions that we want to ask, we're going to have to take very seriously the empirical results that neuroscientists and psychologists are busy producing.
The future of philosophy. The three rising stars in the field.
Recorded in front of a room filled with philosophers in Portland, Oregon.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we've taken Philosophy Talk on the road again. We're in Portland, Oregon, recording the program in front of a live audience, a tough audience, an audience of professional academic philosophers at the 80th annual meeting of the American Philosophical Association, the Pacific Division.
Okay, philosophers, let's hear it for Aristotle.
Our conversations start, as always, at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. And from that oasis of thought, they migrate to this oasis of the air, and from there to our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out.
Today's program is made possible by our friends at Oregon Public Broadcasting, who have been supporting philosophy on the radio since we first started. Today we're going to talk about the future of philosophy.
The future of philosophy. And, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't really see into the future. Maybe our guest can. But I have a thought experiment. Maybe we could do this by induction. Maybe if we consider the past and how philosophy changed over the course of its history, we could figure out how it's going to change in the future. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a great idea. But I must say, if you do ever have a crystal ball for more than 4 hours, you should see your physician.
Let's try the induction. Look, in the 16th and 17th century, philosophy made a turn. Let's call it the philosophy got gripped with the idea. Everybody thought the key to understanding knowledge, what there is, what we ought to do, is to understand ideas and their nature and how they glommed onto reality.
And where did that go? Well, after a couple centuries of that, for a while everybody was convinced the world was nothing but ideas, but they finally came to the sensible conclusion, ideas are damn complicated, and ideas bring more philosophy problems, and they don't solve any of them.
And in the 20th century, there was a rejection of idealism, which had been dominant in the 19th century, and there was this thing called the linguistic turn. Instead of thinking about ideas, let's think about language, you know?
But that was kind of the linguistic detour. Basically, language was supposed to solve, resolve, or dissolve all philosophical problems. Well, language is fascinating, but it turns out to give us more philosophical problems than we had in the first place. But now, I think this is good. I think philosophy is a growth industry. We've got all the problems that Descartes had, all the problems that Hegel had, all the problems that Frege had, and now we've got a whole crop of new problems, and we haven't gotten rid of any of the old ones. It's going to be a great century coming up.
Well, you know, you do have to say, after the linguistic turn came the naturalistic turn and all kinds of other turns, but we did understand language better after the end of all this. Even though we weren't convinced it was the solution to all philosophical problems, we did understand it. So here's my inductive hypothesis. The 21st century will say, oh, you know what? In the 20th century, they made all these mistakes, and now we see beyond them, and they'll reject our turns and come up with new turns of their own.
And they'll say the key to the whole thing is X, but I wonder what X will turn out to have been.
You know what, though? Before we dig into the future of philosophy, let's sum up the past of philosophy. And I know of only one person who can do that in short compass. That's our fast-talking 60-second philosopher, Ian Scholes.
Ian Scholes, there may in fact be a hippopotamus in this room. The arrow will never reach the target. You can't step into the same river twice. The unexamined life is not worth living. If there are no absolutes, the particulars have no meaning. You cannot conceive the many without the one. Behold, Human beings living in an underground den, like ourselves, they see only their own shadows or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave. Necessity is the mother of invention. Nature does nothing uselessly. A whole is that which has beginning, middle, and end. Universes change. Life is an opinion. Love, and do what you like. Good can exist without evil, whereas evil cannot exist without good. Perfection of moral virtue does not wholly take away the passions, but regulates them. God is that than which nothing greater can be thought. One should not increase, beyond what is necessary, the number of entities required to explain anything. Life is brutish, nasty, and short. Do not weep. Do not wax indignant. Understand. There is no hope unmingled with fear, and no fear unmingled with hope. Cogito ergo sum, the ghost and the machine. This is the best of all possible worlds. To be is to be perceived. The greatest good for the greatest number. If all mankind minus one were of one opinion, mankind would be no more justified in silencing that one person than he, if he had the power, would be justified in silencing mankind. All wealth is the product of labor. Nothing is more surprising than the easiness with which the many are governed by the few. Tabula rasa. The supposition that the future resembles the past is not founded on arguments, but is derived entirely from habit. Every individual neither intends to promote the public interest nor knows how much he is promoting it. He intends only his own gain, and he is in this led by an invisible hand to promote an end which was no part of his intention. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. All our knowledge begins with the senses, proceeds then to the understanding, and ends with reason. There is nothing higher than reason. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. If you gaze for long into an abyss, the abyss gazes also into you. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Philosophy is possible as a rigorous science at all only through pure phenomenology. The point of philosophy is to start with something so simple as to not seem worth stating, and end with something so paradoxical that no one will believe it. How do you know there's not a hippopotamus in this room? Before considering the question, what should we do, we ponder this. How must we think? The banality of evil. Hell is other people. We are condemned to be free. Life has become the ideology of its own absence. Normality is death. The mediated concept of truth is that it first admits there is no such thing as absolute pure truth. The new is not a fashion. It is a value. If the highest things are unknowable, then the highest virtue of man cannot be theoretical wisdom. No paradigm ever solves all the problems it defines. In its function, the power to punish is not essentially different from that of curing or educating. To pretend, I actually do the thing. I have therefore only pretended to pretend. Is there a hippopotamus in this room, or are you just glad to see me? I gotta go.
Thanks to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, for distilling the wisdom of 2,500 years of philosophy into about 2 minutes. I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the American Philosophical Association meeting in Portland, Oregon. We're talking about the future of philosophy.
And since we're talking about the future of philosophy, we thought it would be fun to hear from three younger philosophers who are themselves a part of philosophy's future. Please welcome Liz Harmon, currently professor of philosophy at New York University, but headed off to Princeton very soon. Brian Weatherson, professor of philosophy from Cornell University. And Sean Kelly, currently professor of philosophy at Princeton University. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Liz, Brian, and Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Looks like the future of philosophy is going to be better looking than the our generation, Ken.
Your generation,
yeah,
anyway.
Thank you, Ken. Liz, let me start with you, but Brian and Sean, feel free to chime in with your opinions on this topic. I'm going to start with ethics. When I was a graduate student back in the 60s, ethics meant A.J. Ayer, Charles Stevenson. If we'd say, hey, is murder wrong? The professor would say, well, that's a sentence. I wonder if it has a truth value or if it just expresses the emotion. Has ethics changed much since that time? Have the changes been progress or just one trend replaced by another? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a lot going on in ethics right now. Definitely not just asking what our words mean. One of the big things that I think going on right now that troubles me is that people have gotten really worried about arguments that rely on so-called intuitions. There's a thought right now that something goes wrong when we rely on intuitions, and I think this is a mistaken thought.
Well, tell me, what do you mean? So somebody asked me, would murder be wrong in this or that circumstance? I said, seems wrong to me. You think that's bad? I mean, well, why is that? And then you try and figure out what our intuitions about wrongness or the wrongness of murder are tracking or not tracking. Linguists do that stuff all the time. What's wrong with them?
So I think there's nothing wrong with starting from the recognition that murder is wrong and going from there. But what I see is people who do think there's something wrong, people who think that we shouldn't be relying on intuitions, and there's a lot of suspicion of intuitions these days. And partly, you know, everyone agrees murder is wrong, but there are some things that people deeply disagree about. And the fact that people disagree about, say, whether early abortion is permissible makes people think that you can't rely on the claim that early abortion is permissible in making any arguments.
Well, let me see if I understand here. Now, back in the day, intuitionism meant people like Ross who thought you intuited certain moral principles. But you seem to be talking about intuitions as a kind of a person's reaction to a particular case, right, or a fairly well-described case. And as I understand, a lot of people have the view that we have these moral intuitions, and the purpose of moral theory is to explain the intuitions, just as it's kind of analogous to in science you explain experiments with your theory. And are you saying you adopt that view, that you think that's fairly sound?
Well, I don't like the word intuition. You know, that's the word used by people who are trying to raise this problem. I think that what they're talking about are just some of our beliefs, you know, our beliefs about specific cases. But in general, we should reason from the beliefs that we have. And so I think, of course, we should rely on our intuitions because we should rely on our beliefs.
Oh, so you think, okay, I think I misunderstood you. You think it's good to rely on our intuitions.
Oh, yes.
Right. But you said something that would make one wonder how we can, because you can ask the question, whose intuition? Right? I mean, somebody raised in certain circumstances might think infanticide is okay. I mean, if I were, I don't know, in ancient Greece, in certain circumstances, there were a poverty-stricken person, too many children or something, I don't know. But you can imagine circumstances in which somebody might think, oh, that's all right. But, you know, as upper-middle-class Westerners might think, eh, heck no. So whose intuitions get to carry the day?
Well,
and does philosophy have some kind of distinctive method for deciding whose intuitions are privileged?
Well, the short answer is that when you are trying to figure out the truth, you should rely on your beliefs. And when you are trying to convince someone of something, you should use premises that they believe.
Brian or Sean, what do you think here? Brian.
So I agree with Liz. You have to start with things that are plausible, with things that you come to the subject area knowing. There's a kind of a thought, I think, running through some of this criticism, that we can try and start from some absolutely fundamental point. We can try and sort of get outside the whole problem and look from the outside and say, is early abortion impermissible? But for any problem we come across, whether it be a problem about, you know, how to fix a car or a problem about the meaning of life, we have to start with, as always, what we know. And it's a myth that we can separate out the things we know about sort of mundane things like where the tables and chairs are from things we know about what's right and wrong. And I think a lot of the things that people like Liz do that get criticized are just perfectly sensible applications of the principle. Start with what you know and work from there.
But Sean, I want to put a question to you, because you study cognitive neuroscience, among other things. Psychology, cognitive neuroscience, the cognitive scientists have convinced us that human cognition is a mess. People think they know all kinds of things that they turn out not to know. Why should we trust any more in our intuitions about, say, morality than we should trust in our intuitions about sort of ordinary physics? I mean, people seem to have a kind of naive impulse theory of physics that goes back to Aristotle, right? Their intuitions track that. So why should we trust? I mean, you're the guy who studies the mind here, so.
Yeah, I study the mind, but I think this is actually more a question for Liz, but let me say a little something about it. I mean, the reason I think it's a question for Liz is because it seems to me there might be a distinction between the relationship between the intuitions that we have about physics and the truths about physics on the one hand, and the intuitions we have about moral issues and the truths about moral issues on the other hand. It is certainly true that we're not particularly good at getting our intuition straight across circumstances. We're not particularly good often at even being able to predict what our intuitions are going to be in various circumstances. So there are lots of ways that we may not be the best authorities on what our own intuitions are in some kinds of cases. But it sounded like the question you were asking was not so much that, but a question about the relation between our intuitions on the one hand and the truths that those intuitions are intuitions about. And I think that might be an interesting issue.
So look, we'll take this up some more in a little bit. I'll tell our audience this is a special edition of Philosophy Talk coming to you from the 80th annual meeting of the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association in Portland, Oregon. We're discussing philosophy in the 21st century with Liz Harmon, Brian Weatherson, and Sean Kelly.
We've been discussing whether there's been progress in the field of ethics in the last 50 years, and if so, what in the world it was. We're going to broaden our discussion to other domains of philosophy when we pick up after the break. And we'll take questions from some of the philosophers in our audience.
Metaphysics, epistemology, language, mind, and questions from our studio audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Nugget from the 60s, now in the shape of Target TV commercials. That's how the younger generation has heard of Max Frost and the Troopers, Shape of Things to Come. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. We're discussing philosophy in the 21st century with Liz Harmon of NYU, Brian Weatherson of Cornell, and Sean Kelly of Princeton.
We're coming to you from the 80th annual meeting of the American Philosophical Association, Pacific Division, in Portland, Oregon. We have a room filled with philosophers, and we'll hear from them as well in just a moment.
Liz, I want to just take you back just a second before we move on to metaphysics, ontology, language, all that stuff. So here we are in the 21st century, and psychology has taught us not to trust people's cognitive mechanisms, not to think that they're automatically reliable. So tell me why you think this, I mean, as a thoroughly modern 21st century philosopher, shouldn't you be highly skeptical of this method of intuition testing? It sounds to me, that's kind of like the linguistic turn, you know, you get some upper middle class white guys, you say, what would you say about such and such?
Showing that we're not 100% reliable isn't the same as showing that we shouldn't be trusted. Our eyesight isn't 100% reliable either, but we still should rely on our eyesight. And without a particular reason to think that a particular belief that we hold is mistaken, we should keep holding that belief.
Let me ask you another question along a slightly different line. The world has so changed. Technology, what we can do to human beings. John sometimes has said, technology is good at making up problems that philosophy lacks the conceptual resources to solve. Do you think the 21st century presents us with problems that require new kind of conceptual resources in the field of ethics?
Yeah, I don't think that we already have answers to questions of what to do if we have artificial wombs, for example. What if the question isn't just abortion or continuing a pregnancy? What if the question is taking out that fetus and growing it another way? Yeah, these are whole new territories.
They're whole new territory. Are they whole new territory conceptually? Do we need more kind of armor, more machinery to solve them, or?
Wouldn't a lot more attention to philosophy of language really clear up most of these problems? I mean, like if we really got straight about identity and indexicals, wouldn't most of these problems just kind of fade away?
I don't think so, no. You know, I work on questions about moral status. Do fetuses have moral status? And artificial intelligence, for example, just raises new questions. We're going to encounter beings that we're going to have to ask new questions about which things count morally.
Okay, so Brian, let me switch to you for a second. One thing that happened in the 20th century, I'm speaking in broad terms, is that philosophy became a highly technical discipline and with that came a kind of increasing specialization, so that to many people outside philosophy, to many of our fellow humanists, philosophy came to look like a kind of technical scientific discipline or set of technical scientific disciplines and not like broad humanistic inquiry. Is that going to continue?
I think to some extent it won't. I think, and partially I think that because, like you started with, I think one way to think about the future is look back at the past of philosophy as well. Except I think the time that most resembles the late 20th century is in some ways the late 19th century. In the late 19th century, there are also an enormous number of people who we might call philosophers. They at the very least worked in departments with the word philosophy in the title of them. Who did a lot of quite technical work. Now, what happened is a lot of those people either personally or had their students move into other fields. If you look back at the most particularly the history of economics in English-speaking countries, a lot of the great economists of the period are all in departments of philosophy or departments of moral sciences or the like. One of the things I think will happen a lot is our conception of what is philosophy will change. The other thing I think is that there's so much to be gained by people breaking out of the mold of specialization that has, to a large extent, cropped up. I know in some of the worst mistakes I make come from not paying enough attention to the relationship between what I do and what goes on in adjacent fields. It's remarkable how much time you can spend working on what makes a belief rational or justified without thinking about what a belief is and how badly wrong you can go going down that path. I don't think that people are going to keep on just pushing into these fields if there's so much opportunity for advancement outside them.
You raise a very good point about where the talent in philosophy comes from. And from the vantage point of someone who's been around for a while, you see it coming from different places. A lot of the people that would have gone into philosophy in the 50s and 60s went into linguistics in the late 60s and 70s. A lot of people that were of the types that were going into philosophy since the 60s and 70s started going to computer science in the 80s and 90s. We still seem to get these incredibly talented people. Each generation seems to know more than the one before. Let me ask a question to Sean. Sean, you've got this combination of interests, neuroscience and phenomenology. Now, that would sound strange to a philosopher a half century ago. I guess it won't sound strange to a philosopher a half century from now. How do you do that? You do kind of like you introspect and do phenomenology Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you kind of look in your auto cerebroscope Tuesday, Thursday, and how do you combine those interests?
I actually don't think it would sound so strange to some philosophers or psychologists or neuroscientists either 50 or 100 years ago. You had in France 50 years ago, for instance, a number of philosophers, a guy I'm interested in, for instance, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who did phenomenology and also was very interested in empirical work in the cognitive neuroscience of the day. 100 years ago, you had someone like William James, who was very interested in introspective reports about the nature of various aspects of human experience, but also very interested in empirical work. So I think it's not actually so strange in the last 50 or 100 years to have this combination of interests. And I think it's going to become less and less strange as we sort of push forward into the future, because in order to get really clear on the philosophical questions that we want to ask about the nature of perceptual experience, for instance, or the nature of the mental, we're going to have to take very seriously the empirical results that neuroscientists and psychologists are busy producing that are sort of roughly speaking in the same general area.
I'd like to invite our listening studio audience, if you have questions or comments, we're eager to hear from you. We have an audience of academic philosophers here, so if you have a question or comment, come up to the mic, and we'll try and get you into this discussion. And we have a question now.
Lori Schrag at Cal Poly Pomona. My question is, how does philosophy today, as a discipline, uniquely contribute to human knowledge?
That's a good question. Richard Rorty says it doesn't. Right, that the game of knowledge, the game of philosophy, is a contributor to knowledge rather than a teller of stories. That's the a remnant of the past. What do any of you think?
Well, I think it's unlikely that philosophy uniquely contributes to human knowledge. I think a lot of the best work that philosophers do is work that non-philosophers also do. If philosophers were just doing something totally unique, I'd worry we'd really lost touch with the rest of inquiry. But it's easy to look around, look at people in political philosophy who are doing similar things to at least some people in political science, look at people in philosophy of science doing similar work to theoretical scientists, look at philosophers of mind working similarly to cognitive scientists. In some ways, well, again, we'd have to know more about the history to know how unique this is. This is one of the striking characteristics in the modern age, that the connections between philosophers and their colleagues in other departments is often as strong as with other philosophers.
The philosopher Locke, I think, said that philosophy ought to be an underlabor of the sciences. The idea is you kind of come along like the guy at the end of the parade and deal with the problems left over from the sciences, as opposed to philosophers have thought philosophy was the kind of the queen of the sciences. Now, the 20th century seems to be mainly in favor of Locke's conception of philosophy, not as the grand theorist. Philosophers not as telling us how to live. Philosophers is coming along, making distinctions, asking questions others are too busy to ask. Which do you think that's going to continue through the 21st century?
Liz.
One question is, are philosophers learning anything, coming to know something? Another question is, are we contributing that knowledge? Are we getting it out? And I am frustrated that we don't do that more. And I think philosophy talk is great because you guys are doing that, bringing philosophy to a wider audience. And I really admire this book Peter Singer wrote called The President of Good and Evil, in which he tries to take seriously what President Bush has said about his ethical views, but bring some real philosophical lessons to bear. You know, ethics has really, there is some progress. We've figured out some things, and he's trying to bring that to a wider audience.
So we have another question from our studio audience.
Yeah, I'm Mark Perlman. I teach at Western Oregon University. And one thing, you can look at the history of philosophy as many areas that used to be part of philosophy that sort of spun off, like anthropology, sociology, psychology. And I'm curious to know, what's the next spinoff going to be?
Good question.
Good question. Sean, you're in the spin-off business, kind of?
You're a spin-off kind of guy, yeah.
I'm afraid I'm already part of the last spin-off. I mean, psychology is one of the things that's spun off from philosophy, so to speak. I'm not sure I can make predictions about what the next one is going to be. But I can say something that's sort of related to both that issue and the issue that was just brought up about the relation between philosophy and the sciences that spin off from it. I think that it's true that the underlaborer account of the role of philosophy has been pretty prevalent in the 20th century. But I think there's another role that philosophy can play and has played, at least to some extent, in the 20th century. And that's the role, this is not a sort of unique claim of mine, but that's the role of thinking about the conceptual foundations of the various sciences that have spun off from it. And in particular, I think this is true when it comes to various kinds of social sciences that have research programs or research paradigms that depend implicitly on assumptions about the nature of the kinds of beings that we are as human beings that are often slightly weird or slightly quirky assumptions that philosophers are really in a position to push on in a way that people working within the paradigm aren't so much in a position to push on. So I think that's one of the ways that philosophy can relate to its spin-offs.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're saying, for example, economics, a bona fide science with a Nobel Prize and all that stuff, has this goofball conception of human agencies, and philosophers ought to be questioning it and challenging it.
We have more questions from our studio audience.
Yeah, Peter Godfrey Smith from Harvard. I'd like to put some of your guests on the spot here and ask them for their favorite example in recent years of a concrete piece of progress in philosophy, something definite that we've learned that we didn't know before.
Very good question. Brian, you look like you're chopping at the bit here.
It depends what you mean by recent. Philosophers always start with it depends.
Is that
Aristotle?
Depends on what the meaning of is.
It depends on what the meaning of is. I think the work that's been done on starting with David Kaplan's work on pronouns and working up through, including both of our hosts here, on the relationship between the environment that a speaker is in and the meanings of their words. So starting with simple cases like what's the relationship between the person who's talking and the meaning and what's expressed by the sentence, I'm hungry. If I say that, it means Brian's hungry. If Liz says that, it means Liz is hungry. The advances that have been made on how to formalize that, how to tame some of that what started off seeming quite radical context sensitivity to environment, and put it into a broad theory, make it look like a theory of meaning in terms of truth conditions might yet work after all, is really just an enormous advance over the, at least over our lifetimes.
Sean, what do you think?
I want to say that I think that there's an assumption behind the question that I think is maybe not a fair one. And the assumption seemed to be that philosophy isn't really contributing much unless it's giving us concrete answers to definite questions. And I think that's at least in some cases, a kind of category mistake. I think that one of the things that philosophy can do, starting all the way back with the Socratic kind of philosophy, is just ask questions, just make people realize that the things that they take to be definite answers in their domain actually aren't so definite, to make them think harder and harder and harder about the security that they have, about the answers that they've given to various questions. And I think that philosophy can do that both for various kinds of philosophical questions and also for the kinds of questions that go on in various kinds of sciences. And I think that's a genuine contribution that philosophy makes without its ever getting to the point of giving a definite answer to anything.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're doing a special program in front of a live audience in Portland, Oregon, an audience of professional academic philosophers. We're talking about the future of philosophy with Liz Harmon, Brian Weatherson, and Sean Kelly. And Liz, I want to know what you think about that last question about, and you know, a concrete example of philosophical progress.
Well, I think a concrete example of philosophical progress, this goes back to the 70s, but Judy Thompson's argument that even if we think fetuses are persons, abortion can still be permissible, I think that that was tremendous progress. And she said, look, suppose that you found yourself in a hospital and your kidneys were cycling somebody's blood and you had to choose between staying for 9 months to cycle their blood or unhooking yourself and they would die. Would you have to stay? She said you wouldn't have to stay. And this is an argument that actually has been popularized, and people talk about it in law schools, and people talk about it, and I think it really contributed to our understanding of abortion.
Is that the last bit of progress in ethics?
No, but it's a vivid bit.
Okay, we have another question from our live audience.
I'm Emanuela Bianchi from the University of California, Berkeley, and there's a famously entrenched division in professional philosophy in the English-speaking world between analytic philosophy and continental philosophy, that is Anglo-American philosophy, and philosophy that's done coming from more French-German traditions, for example. And I've heard whispers of a détente lately between these traditions, and that pleases me greatly as a continental philosopher, and I wondered if any of the panelists had any comments about that.
This is a perfect question. You've actually usurped our third segment, because this is a question for Sean Kelly, who's lived this divide.
Yes, I've lived this divide because I am interested both in the French and German philosophers of especially the first half of the 20th century, and also in Anglo-American work in philosophy of mind. And I think it's fair to say that there's at least less animosity between the groups than there used to be. I still think that there's a certain kind of distrust among the sort of advocates of each way of doing philosophy. But I don't think there ought to be. The way I think about the issue, the phenomenologists of the first half of the 20th century, people like Husserl and Heidegger and Sartre and Merleau-Ponty, were interested in questions that had to do with the nature of the intentionality of the mental. That's philosopher talk for the fact that they were interested in the question, how are mental states get to be about objects and states of affairs in the world? When I have a thought about the chair, it's really about the chair. That's what philosophers call intentionality. And the phenomenologists, broadly speaking, were interested in intentionality. And intentionality is still one of the central issues in contemporary analytic philosophy of mind. So I think there ought to be a détente if there isn't.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing philosophy in the 21st century with Liz Harmon of NYU, Brian Weatherson of Cornell, and Sean Kelly of Princeton.
In our next segment, we're going to continue with what we've just been discussing, the great divide between analytic and continental philosophy, and we'll also touch a little on the emerging interdisciplinary character of philosophy.
Philosophy, continental or analytic? And more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Timbuk 3, and the future's so bright, I gotta wear shades. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing philosophy in the 21st century with three philosophers of the future, NYU's Elizabeth Harmon, Cornell's Brian Weatherson, and Sean Kelly from Princeton. Sean, I want to ask you about, we talked in the last segment a bit about this analytic continental divide. Maybe we can talk about that some more, but I want to ask you a broader question about the fragmentation of philosophy. I think that philosophy is not really one thing. It's many different things. It's just what people who call themselves philosophers do. So there's no deep unity to it. It's just a bunch of disparate things. What do you think? Am I wrong or right about that? And does that matter for the future, this kind of fragmentation?
I don't think it matters much, but I think it's true. I think that I don't think there's a single method that characterizes philosophy. I don't think there's a single subject area that characterizes philosophy. I don't think it's easy to say what makes a philosophical sort of approach to something philosophical at all. I think in a certain way it's a catch-all for what's not already in some discipline or another.
So if we ask what's the future of philosophy going to be, we're asking what is this fragmented, multiple, diverse thing going to look like? It's going to be multiple and fragmented and diverse. I guess maybe we could try and track strands of it or something.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. I think what you can do is I don't think there's going to be an answer to what the future of philosophy in toto is, but there's going to be some answer, or we can speculate at any rate, about what the future of a particular area of philosophy is.
I have my own view about the essence of philosophy that may not appeal to this cerebral, academic, professional crowd, but I think what holds philosophy together is what you teach kids in their first philosophy course or two, which is pretty much the same no matter what science does or culture does. You know, you teach them to ask who they are and why they believe all the crap they believe, and you teach them how to doubt it, and whatever the current things that everybody believes are, you teach them the opposite. If they all believe in God, you give them the reasons not to believe in God, and if none of them believe in God, you trot out your best arguments.
Brian, you want to weigh in there?
Well, I want to continue. I think all of philosophy just kind of comes from that, and then you look at the arguments and the sub-arguments, and if you do a good enough job, your university will give you some time off to play with these ideas on your own. That's philosophy research. That's my own view. Don't ask anybody else to accept it.
Brian Weatherson wants to weigh in here.
I agree entirely about what you do in a first philosophy course, but it's worth remembering how historically constructed those kinds of things are. In the 60-second philosophy before, we had a couple of quips from Marx on the labor theory of value and the like. Now, when I'm teaching 101, I don't talk about Marx's theory of value, not because it would be something the students don't believe. I reckon I have zero Marxists in my class, that it would be a great challenge, but because for one reason or another, that question, which surprisingly, given it's a question about value, has ceased to be part of philosophy, and I think that's because there's another entire department whose job it is to study it. So I think that you still have to sort of take account of what Sean was saying in sort of picking why we pick the things we do in the 101 classes.
I think it's one of the job descriptions of philosophy, one that maybe in the upper reaches of academia, we don't engage in enough, is to reimagine cultural possibilities. Because one of the things that I think philosophy has always done and will always do is deliver to the news to people. So you can't sustain these old forms of life because they're not justifiable. They're inconsistent. They're incoherent. They contradict the deliverances of science. Then the question is, well, what do you do about that? You have to re-envision cultural possibilities. And I think that's always been one of the job descriptions of philosophy. I think it's true, though, you don't get very much academic credit for doing that.
I just want to point out, though, that our current administration, and I'm not one of its great admirers, but in a way it's a very philosophical administration. As you say, there's this tradition, goes back to Barry Goldwater's book, The Conscience of a Conservative, that really pointed out philosophical principles. And then, there was the neocons. There's a lot of philosophy there. Bill Bennett, philosopher, John Silber, philosopher. The neocons who helped promote the Iraq War, a lot of philosophy and political science there. So the problem isn't so much that philosophy has little impact. It's that, from my point of view, the liberal and left-wing parts of the country have been letting their philosophy kind of go to hell. It doesn't have much effect. There isn't much aggressive. The word liberal was taken away and thrown in the ash bin of history without much of a protest. So it's not philosophy in general. I think it's a certain kind of philosopher that isn't making their voice heard in the places that count.
Brian Weatherson.
I wanted to be a little bit heretical about this. I think that there's certainly it's a very important role for philosophers to come up with big ideas and hopefully good ideas that will become that can often become important parts of the organization of society down the track. To as the sort of old saying goes, there's nothing as powerful as an idea whose time has come. What I don't think that implies is there's any special obligation on us as philosophers to get into get involved, particularly in topical issues. We might have that obligation as citizens, but the fact is there's already quite a lot of people talking about the erosion of liberties under the Bush administration. There's already quite a lot of people talking about a lot of the issues to do with abortion. I think philosophers should try and do the things they can do that other people can't do, and that's going to involve looking at things that seem at first much more abstract, things that seem at first much more big picture. I mean, to sort of go way, way back into the past, it's, you know, Locke writing the two treaties of government, which 70, 80 years later become incredibly important for the founding of the United States.
Well, but I'm not sure there's a deep disconnect there, because it seems to me one of the things philosophy's for is envisioning how possibly something could be. You know, how possibly could a mind be a brain? How possibly could the moral truths be determined by facts about nature or something like that? And one of the kinds of how possibly is how possibly could we have a life together given this, that, or the other thing? Right, given the diversity of opinions and interests, given the no a priori way to settle disputes, how possibly could we have a life together? And philosophy envisions that, and that gives rise, it seems to me, to cultural formations. But we have a question from our live studio audience.
Yes, I'm Aaron Chaffetz. I'm an undergraduate at Reed College. I wanted to ask, I certainly wouldn't try to argue, especially not to this audience, that we shouldn't be involved in topical issues, should that be our desire. However, personally, my interest in philosophy, my heart in philosophy, tends to lie in issues that I think are less readily applicable. And there are many such issues, but just take, for example, being a nominalist or a realist about properties, you know. Can we not justify research in these areas just for their own good, or can we? Or does the fact that we can't justify them if we can't mean that we should cut it out?
I think you have to go back to my thought, which I deeply believe, that philosophy is at its core a fragmented discipline with many agendas, many houses, many mansions, and some people live in these and some people live in those, and you try and all the people who live in these different things try and reproduce themselves and thrive, and some succeed and some don't, and what emerges is a fragmented, diverse, divided discipline. So sure, you can do ontology, but that doesn't mean you can't do trying to reimagining culture.
Yeah, let me go back to Ken's question at the beginning. Inductively, what does the 21st century look like? Well, there's one piece of hopeful evidence for philosophy as conceived as an abstract discipline with the problems of the kind I love. The 20th century was probably the worst century we've ever had in terms of suffering and innocents killed and genocides and all sorts of things, overpopulation, basically ruining the environment. It was just a terrible century, and yet I think it's a golden age of philosophy. More good philosophy, more good logic, more philosophy books, more clarification of these abstract topics than ever before. So from that point of view, the 21st century is getting off to a great start for philosophy. It looks like it's going to be another horrible century that will drive lots of good minds like Russell's into occasionally protesting, but mostly thinking about the nature of numbers and logic. So cheer up.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're doing a special program in front of a live studio audience here in Portland, Oregon, at the 80th annual meeting of the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association. We're talking about the future of philosophy with three philosophers of the future, Brian Weatherson, Sean Kelly, and Liz Harmon. And we've got a question from our live studio audience.
Hi, I'm Harriet Baber. I'm a professor at the University of San Diego. And I emphatically agree with Professor Perry that the best thing that we do as philosophers is teach undergraduates in their first or second philosophy courses to awaken from their dogmatic slumbers, their slumbers concerning various sorts of cultural relativism and all of the other stuff that's in the air. Unfortunately, however, I think most of us professionally are being pressed by the assessment movement to produce results that can be quantified, to come up with various instruments, as they call them, where we are to come up with pretests and post-tests and show that our students have learned how to do calculations they couldn't do before, or how to list facts that they couldn't list before. And this is a movement which is part of the business-oriented thrust that academia has been forced into. Now, I personally believe that this is counterproductive because we could produce tests and ask students, who was a dualist? Descartes, Spinoza, somebody else, and we can give them tests to see if they know how to do various kinds of calculations, but that's not what we should be doing. So for practical purposes, I'm wondering how we, who know better, can convince those who fund us and those who support us that what we're doing in awakening students from their dogmatic slumbers to be critical reasoners and good citizens is worthwhile.
So, okay, look, you guys are the philosophers of the future. John and I are passing into ancient history, especially John. So how are we going to make this, how are we going to reproduce this thing that we do in a generation younger than you? What are the prospects for our reproducing philosophy in younger folks in the next generation? Are there insurmountable obstacles? Are you optimistic? Do you find young people even younger than yourselves thrilled at the idea of philosophy or what? Each of you make a comment about that.
I do find young people thrilled at the idea of philosophy, although I have to confess I'm not always certain that even the best of them are going to flourish in, as professional philosophers. I think it's a very difficult profession to go into. It's a very difficult profession to make a, you know, to make a living in. And some of them, I think, don't end up going into professional philosophy because of that or because they're scared of that. But I think that even so, we get some, I get some amazingly smart and interesting undergraduates who, despite the fact that they don't become professional philosophers, become really, really interested in philosophy. And those are the ones that I think are hopeful.
Brian.
Yeah, I mean, if the worry is about perpetuating academic philosophy, there's certainly no problem about getting people into it. After all, if you went to any one of these conferences over the last 20 years, you'd be like, how are we going to find jobs for all these people we've got if we have to go to the other problem? That's a quite easy problem to live with. I was actually a little bit surprised about the focus on assessment tasks. I don't know about everyone else here. I normally get mostly assessed on sort of students' own done evaluations, which all correlate with, well, all kinds of things other than how good a teacher I am.
So, Liz, are you optimistic about the reproduction of philosophy? I don't just mean in professional circles, but in the culture more broadly. Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, when I think about ensuring that people get interested in philosophy and ensuring that we can get people excited about philosophy, I agree that we haven't had any problem. We have plenty of people in our graduate schools, but I'm very concerned with who we have in our schools. And I'm concerned that we don't have enough women and we don't have enough members of minorities. And I think that not enough attention is paid to who we're attracting and who we could be attracting that we're somehow turning off.
So on that note, I'm going to thank all three of you for joining us. It's been a really great conversation. Our guests have been Liz Harmon, professor of philosophy from New York University, Brian Weatherson, professor of philosophy from Cornell University, and Sean Kelly, professor of philosophy from Princeton University. Liz, Brian, Sean, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And we also want to thank everyone in our studio audience for participating in the program. Give yourselves a round of applause.
So, John, what do you think about the future of philosophy? It looks to me like if our three guests are representative examples of the philosophers of the future, philosophy is in really good hands. What do you think?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. But I do think that Professor Baber brought up a very good point at the end. The key to the strength of philosophy isn't that the industrialists of the world will insist that we train a lot of philosophers, or that the governments will insist on it, or the army will insist on it. It's going to be that universities really find it a valuable thing to have taught, and so they hire philosophy teachers, and they do philosophy as professional philosophers. Some of them are going to have other jobs. Some of them are going to get jobs in computer science. But that's really the key, and I think it's important for us to keep our eye on that particular ball. I'd like to see the measure of philosophy be you have 100 questions, and on the first day you have your freshmen fill in how certain they are of the answers to these questions. And then you give them the same questions at the end, and if they're not a lot less certain about the answers to those questions, if they don't know less at the end of the course than they knew at the beginning of the course, you ought to be fired.
Yeah. Well, you know, You know, I think that philosophy is absolutely vital to the intellectual landscape of our times. I think philosophy is the most interdisciplinary undertaking there is. Philosophy is the best reimaginer of cultural possibilities that there is. Philosophy asks hard, deep questions. Philosophy, you know, gives you sometimes a synthetic vision of diverse things. Sometimes it digs in a deep analysis, deep analytical questions about things that nobody else asks. So I actually think what would improve universities in America and what would improve undergraduate education in America is if philosophy departments became the size of English departments, right? And English departments shrunk, but that's, you know. So anyway, this conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can download podcasts from our website as well. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Thanks to Jack Galmish, Amy Walker, Bill St. James, and all the folks at Oregon Public Broadcasting. And, of course, Rujun Shen, Neil Van Leeuwen, and our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
And a special thanks to Anita Silvers and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association for making this program possible.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of wonderful KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders, even if they should.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.